are so beautiful. And every little thing you do got me uncontrollable. I know that if you gave me just one chance, I'd be all you'd ever need to get by. Let me into your life.
A life of love and ecstasy.
Take a chance on. All right. And the previous program was Neurodiversity Experts Talk with Natalie Tandiway. And that is heard on Fridays at 2 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Now stay tuned for Ecologic coming up.
You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, then tell me where we gonna plant our seed. It makes me wanna cry. For the children, makes me wanna cry. For Mother Earth, makes me wanna cry. We could do, there's so much we could know if we listen.
Ken, you're muted.
Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. Ken Gale is here, and I'm Sally Geller.
Sally's doing it. And I'm Donna Stein. Some. And 30th, 2021. Somebody's got their speaker on or two devices on. What's a live broadcast without some technical stuff? When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said. Microbes do a lot more than cause disease. In fact, we could not live without them.
To go with their name. Phoebe?
Hi, my name is Phoebe Mankiewicz. I'm an interdisciplinary PhD student at Yale Center for Ecosystems and Architecture.
Elizabeth?
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Hinnos. I'm an assistant professor at the NYU Kansas School of Engineering.
So what is a microbe anyway, and why should we care?
I can take that one.
Yeah.
So microbes or microorganisms are single-celled organisms, meaning that they're a whole organism that is just one single cell. If you think about that in comparison, the human body has trillions of cells. And so a microbe is a tiny little organism, and one of the reasons why we need it is that humans, just like all other multicellular organisms, live in symbiosis with pretty much just as many bacterial cells in and on our bodies as we have human cells.
Anything to add to that, Phoebe?
Yeah, so microbes are really important to our health. And one thing that Elizabeth and I study in our work together is the study of microbiomes. And microbiomes are really biomes of microorganisms. So you can sample a microbiome of your desk, of your skin, of your mouth, of your gut. And what we're finding is that the microbiomes of the human skin and the human gut have a really important impact on our health. And the other thing we're finding is that urban inhabitants, urban humans, tend to have less diversity of microbes than the microbes you would find on a farmer or in the soil.
Better, worse?
Speaking of soils, actually, I think it's also interesting to talk about microorganisms in the soil or in other ecosystems. And so microorganisms are responsible for a lot of the important metabolisms that are happening in the soil and other environments. And so you can think of metabolisms as molecular transformations, so transforming one type of molecule into another type of molecule. And oftentimes, microbes perform really essential metabolisms that then provide essential molecules that other organisms, more complex organisms, might need.
You better explain that further. What do you mean they transform one molecule into another?
If you think of, we're referring to metabolic pathways. And so these types of transformations are something that our bodies do chemically on a regular basis. So imagine, for example, that you drink a glass of wine in the evening, and then by the morning, the ethanol in that glass of wine has been transformed into water and carbon dioxide. And so that transformation doesn't happen in just one step. It's actually a series of chemical reactions that are catalyzed or facilitated by a series of different enzymes that are performing those reactions. And so when we talk about metabolisms or metabolic pathways, we're actually talking about the concerted action of multiple enzymes that perform a series of chemical reactions that kind of take us from point A to point B. An example of important microbial metabolisms in the environment can be found in the context of bioremediation, for example. So there's more and more aspects of our environment that are contaminated with industrial waste, petrochemical waste, and oftentimes we find microorganisms that have adapted to those toxic conditions and that are able to degrade those molecules that are toxic to humans. And so in that case, also, we talk about these metabolic pathways or bioremediation-specific metabolic pathways where these microorganisms are able to transform these molecules into maybe simpler, less toxic molecules in the environment.
Wow.
Microbes can help clean up these messes?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, I said, so you're saying that these microbes, with their metabolic action, can help clean up the pollution?
Sure thing. Yeah, I mean, it's happening. Cool. It's happening in a bunch of different environments that have been studied. For example, here in our very own New York City, which boasts two Superfund sites, one in the Gowanus Canal. We've been studying the microorganisms in the Gowanus Canal, and we find that they encode a bunch of really interesting bioremediation functions that correspond to the contaminants that historically are known to have been disposed of in the canal waterway.
Phoebe, you were nodding your head while Elizabeth was speaking. Do you have something to add?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's the microbiomes that we're studying in urban and also not urban areas cover a huge range of diversity. So one of the most diverse classes of microorganisms, groups of microorganisms, are found in the soil and associated with plant roots. And there are these classes, groups of microorganisms that evolve in the Gowanus Canal. So groups of microorganisms will evolve around whatever resources they're given.
Wow.
And this is something that we think about in urban areas as well, is how can we shape the microbiomes around us to become healthier for humans or in order to get something specific out of them, like metabolizing hydrocarbons. So in that way, the study of microbiome is very much context dependent, and also thinking about almost a grassroots way of evolving populations in a direction that we want.
Wow. I went to a microbes conference at the Museum of Natural History a few years ago, and I just loved that conference. And one of the things they mentioned is that microbes exchange genes, which I just blew my mind, because of course, you know, people can't do that. Animals can't do that. So what's going on? Microbes can actually exchange genes with each other.
Actually, we do that, but we only do it
once.
Oh,
we do?
Sexual reproduction. With microbes, it's obviously very different. And so when we look at a microbial population, we can figure out what genes are there, and when you take sort of if you take a swab of, say, a soil sample, and you sequence it, and Elizabeth is much better at this than I, so jump in whenever you want, Elizabeth. But when you sequence it, we usually can, because the populations are so diverse, we can usually figure out who is in that sample, so what kinds of microbes, or what they're doing. But as you say, they can exchange genes, so it's difficult from that level to figure out who is doing what.
And also to add to that, that ability to be able to swap genes and swap genetic information in and out, like during the lifespan of a single organism, is what allows them to adapt so quickly to new environments. And so, organisms like humans that have longer generation times and it takes longer to be able to generate diversity can't adapt as quickly to changing conditions. And so I think that really, looking to microbes as a resource for adaptation to a rapidly changing climate is really important, because microorganisms are able to adapt to the kind of rapidly changing conditions that we're observing a lot faster than multicellular organisms like plants or animals. And so hopefully we can learn to kind of co-opt or collaborate with these microscopic organisms to kind of learn means for collaborative survival on a changing planet.
So that means that if one microbe adapts to a changing environment through this gene swapping, they can all do it.
They all have that potential, correct? And descendants of that particular cell will also have that genetic capacity until they lose it. So the acquisition of those capacities is just as easy as the loss of those capacities.
How does this translate to useful information for our listeners? Besides knowing about sexy microbes.
I think for our listeners, what's interesting to think about is that there's an abundant and ubiquitous, invisible biological component of all our environments, even the environments that we think to be as unenvironmental environments as we can imagine, like contaminated canals, for example. And so I think it's interesting to kind of nurture an awareness for the fact that there are invisible living organisms around us all the time. And think about ways that we can nurture that relationship too. So it can be as simple as, you know, having plants in your home or doing some gardening or just spending time in your garden, period, with your hands in the dirt.
Having plants in your home? What do you mean?
For sure. Well, so I think anything that we can do to diversify our environment is a good thing. How exactly that would work, where, you know, we're really not quite sure. But we do know that urban environments tend to be a lot less diverse from a microbial perspective than rural environments. And that difference in diversity has been correlated with also propensities towards different types of adverse health conditions, like autoimmune diseases, for example, such as asthma.
I mean, if you think about it, just kind of, say in New York City, for example, the Bronx has, by area, some of the largest green space of any of the boroughs, but it also has the largest areas of no green space, because Van Cortlandt Park is so huge, but it's all in one place. Then you'll have huge swaths of, you know, the South Bronx that doesn't have any park space. So if you think about someone who's living next to Van Cortlandt Park, who has access to go walking in Van Cortlandt Park and pick up pine cones and get their hands in the dirt, their microbiome might look very different from someone who lives in Port Morris, for example, next to, you know, the transfer station. And so it's these kinds of differences that seem to have an impact on many, many, many health impacts downstream. So the incidence of asthma or the incidence of atopic skin conditions. So going out and, you know, planting plants in your garden, if you have one, may seem like a really simple thing, but it can have a huge impact on your health, especially if you get your kids to do it too.
That brings me to your work on the green walls. Can anybody have a green wall in their home, and why is that such an important part of your work?
Well, so the microbes associated with plants, kind of like soil, are very diverse and very different from the microbes you would find on your skin. So, for example, we know that farmers who work with their hands with plants all the time have a skin microbiome that looks closer to that of a plant than a plant-associated microbiome than someone who's living in, for example, Port Morris, not to pick on Port Morris, but in the Bronx, or someone who doesn't have access to green space. So theoretically, this is an active area of investigation, of research that both Elizabeth and I work in, and those that we work with in my program at ELC. But having plants in your homes, it's not only good for growing food, but it might also be good for your microbiome. We know this from, you know, people who work with plants already.
And I think one of the things that... Go ahead.
Oh, one of the things that we're trying to work on in kind of general terms is how do we establish microbial metrics of spaces? So we can measure all sorts of things about the spaces that we inhabit, and we design for those metrics. So we can measure temperature, we can measure air quality, we can measure CO2 concentration, we can measure light, and an architect will design for all of those criteria. And so something that we're trying to work on in the field is how do we establish kind of a microbial metric for spaces so that, you know, an architect, when they're designing their next skyscraper or high-rise or office building, they're not only thinking about the metrics of, say, light and temperature, but also this biological metric.
Yeah, you know, Ecologic had a show on the health effects of indoor plants, and they went on for an hour back when we had an hour show, and there's one health effect after another. Indoor plants are so wonderful, and they did not touch on any of the things that you guys just mentioned. So it seems that the more you learn about indoor plants, the better they are for our health.
As long as you don't overwater them.
That's my problem.
So overwatering is worse than underwatering.
Well, of course, the plant would disagree, but by overwatering a house plant, especially a house plant that's grown in soil, you run the risk of mold just because of you're pushing the water content too far to one side. The best way to eliminate mold and you know, one concern that lots of people have about bringing plants indoors is mold, and that's usually from overwatering. Because if you keep the moisture down below a certain level, if you let the soil dry out, you can never have mold, or you can't have mold spores anyway. But if you push it too far in the moisture direction, you're going to have mold, and that's where you start to have problems.
So simple.
Than humans living on them? You know, like, would our pets have different microbes than we would?
Absolutely. There's a huge difference between the microbiomes of homes of people who own pets versus people who don't own pets. And what they're actually finding is there might be what's called a protective effect, meaning that if you have pets and you have that increase in microbial diversity in your home, especially for your children, if your children are young, and you get them exposed to those more complex ecosystems of microbes, they may have fewer health problems down the road.
Wow.
Well, our listeners are very aware of the term biodiversity and how important it is in our environment. It's nice to know that that it goes down to the cellular level as well. We need biodiversity. But once again, right now, the time has just flown by. Yep. There's only so much time, and we need to wrap it up. But thanks, everybody, for joining us. Elizabeth and Phoebe, please give us your full name and a website, and we will put more information, of course, on our website for those of you who are or online. Phoebe?
Yeah, my name is Phoebe Mankiewicz. I'm an interdisciplinary PhD student at the Yale Center for Ecosystems and Architecture, and you can find us at yalec.com.
Repeat that.
yalec.com.
Elizabeth?
My name is Elizabeth Hinnoff. I'm an assistant professor at the NYU Kent School of Engineering, and you can find my research at idm.engineering.nyu.edu.
Repeat that one.
IDM, which is my program, .engineering.nyu.edu.
Great. And you can rely on Ecologic to bring you news of upcoming events and people making a difference, like Phoebe and Elizabeth. This is a most important role for Ecologic and WBAI-FM.
You can listen to this show again and any of our past shows and get environmental news on a variety of topics at www.ecoradio.org.
That's www.ecoradio.org. And Sally,
two brief announcements. There'll be a flotilla protesting the frack gas dance camera plant on the Hudson River on Wednesday, August 4th. If you'd like to be in the flotilla, go to clearwater.org. Go to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki 75th commemoration online global peace gathering on August 5th. Info is on our website.
Yep.
And tune in next week when Ecologic reports back on these events and we discuss the impending extinction of our beloved shorebirds.
Also, to find out when our shows are posted, those of you online, please sign up for our email list. And those of you on Facebook, please like our page. Enter Eco-Logic.
There are many video and audio versions of Ecologic available to you for a donation to WBAI. Go to www.givetowbai.org and choose Ecologic on the drop-down menu after you click on Next, or call 212-209-2950 and say that you want to become a member or a WBAI buddy.
And much appreciation for our excellent engineer, Reggie Johnson. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Tune in next Friday, August 6th at 2:30 p.m. for our report backs.
WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. Twice impeached, one-term President Donald Trump pressured Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen to declare that the election was corrupt in an attempt to help Republican members of Congress try to overturn the election result, according to notes of a December 2020 call Trump held with Rosen and Acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue. During the December 27, 2020 call, Trump pressured Rosen and Donahue to falsely declare the election illegal and corrupt, even after the Justice Department had not uncovered evidence of corrupt, widespread voter fraud. Quote, "Just say the election was corrupt, then leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman," Trump said on the call, according to Donahue's notes. Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee became the third black House Democrat to be arrested in 3 weeks for participating in a voting rights demonstration outside the Hart Senate office building. Quote, "I believe when you are getting into good trouble, when you realize the 15th Amendment has guaranteed the fundamental right to vote, any action that is a peaceful action of civil disobedience is worthy and more to push all of us to do better and to do more," she said in a video on Twitter. USA Today notes that Representatives Joyce Beatty of Ohio and Hank Johnson of Georgia were also arrested in previous weeks for participating in similar voting rights demonstrations. New York City police arrested at least 11 people who shut down a lower Manhattan street in front of City Hall at a Housing Not Shelters demonstration on Thursday. Housing rights advocates were calling out the city's plan to transfer thousands of unhoused people from hotels back to shelters where they face increased precarity and possible COVID exposure. Climbing coronavirus infection rates are threatening the Tokyo Olympics, with two foreign athletes hospitalized and 38 others self-isolating. Japanese officials reported record-breaking infection rates for the city, twice as high as a week ago. The country as a whole reported over 10,000 new cases on Thursday. Tokyo has been under a state of emergency since July 12th, but many residents are ignoring requests to stay at home as the infectious Delta variant spreads. Local media has reported that Japan will likely extend Tokyo's emergency until the end of August and expand it to include neighboring areas and Osaka. A 25-foot totem pole from the Lummi Nation arrived in Washington after a more than 20,000-mile cross-country journey through sacred lands. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and tribal leaders blessed the pole Thursday during a ceremony on the National Mall. It was carved from a 400-year-old red cedar tree, and it will serve to raise awareness of native issues and protecting sacred sites. The United States is returning some 17,000 archaeological treasures to Iraq that were looted during the decades of war and U.S. occupation. Some of the artifacts date back 4,000 years. Baghdad's culture minister praised the move as an unprecedented restitution. Currently in Washington, it's partly sunny and 88 degrees. In New York, it's partly cloudy.